Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and I'm here today for a conversation about one of the, I think, most unjustly unknown Americans of the 20th century. And there's new biography out about this individual, and we're going to be interviewing the author today. And that author is Peter Eisenstadt, who was the associate editor of the Howard Thurman Papers Project and an affiliate member of the Clemson University History Department. He's the author of several books, including Rochdale Village, Robert Moses, 6,000 Families, and New York City's Great Experiment in Integrated Housing. But Terry, we're here to talk about his brand new book from the University of Virginia Press, Against the Hounds of Hell, A Life of Howard Thurman. Peter, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Eric.
Would you start by describing your book to our readers and listeners?
It's a biography of Howard Thurman. It's drawn on the five volumes of paper, the documentary edition that I was the associate editor on, that had been published from like 2009 to 2019. And working on those, I thought that we had provided the foundation for writing a biography. And, you know, and I wrote it. And the papers are proving to be a sort of a boon to a renaissance in Thurman studies. Paul Harvey, distinguished professor of African American Southern religion, published a short biography of Thurman last year. There's another book coming out later two books coming out later this year. And I think we're in the beginning of a Thurman renaissance, where Thurman is beginning to get the recognition that he deserves.
Well, probably quite a few of our listeners don't know too much about Thurman. Could you provide like the 2-minute biographical overview of him, and then we'll kind of move from there?
He was born in Florida in 1899. He grew up in Daytona. He was largely raised by his mother and his grandmother. His grandmother was born into slavery about 1847. He was a very bright young boy. He managed to go to high school, despite the fact there's no high school in Daytona for blacks beyond seventh grade. He went to Morehouse College in Atlanta. Then he went to Rochester Theological Seminary in upstate New York. He was always a mystic and had a very distinctive view of Christianity. He taught for several years at his alma mater and at Spelman, the sister college. 1932, he went to Howard University at a time when it was like the center of black intellectual life in America. 1935, 1936, he took an extended trip to India under the auspices of the American Student Christian Federation. The highlight of the trip is he and his wife, Sue Bailey Thurman, one other man, became the first black Americans to meet with Mahatma Gandhi. He had been a pacifist from his undergraduate years. He wrote about that. In 1944, he left Howard University to become co-pastor and pastor of the Church of Fellowship of All Peoples in San Francisco, which was the first church in the United States organized on an interracial and interdenominational basis. In 1953, he went to Boston University, where he became dean of chapel and professor of spiritual disciplines and resources in the School of Theology. He wrote a number of books. He returned to San Francisco in 1965, and he lived and was active basically until the end of his life in 1981. And he was an influence on James Farmer, Pauli Murray, Martin Luther King, and Jesse Jackson. We can talk about that as well. And you know, that's the potted biography.
Okay. So the last time I did a podcast, I was talking to Jennifer Ratner Rosenhagen, who's a intellectual historian at the University of Wisconsin. And she was asking, you know, what, who else I was interviewing. And I mentioned that my next podcast was with you. And I said, oh, it's this new biography of Thurman. And, you know, she was really interested in this and you know, took down the name of your book and all of this. And, you know, we started talking about why is it that Thurman is such an unknown figure among so many, I mean, really outside of religious circles, both in terms of popular popular understandings of the Black freedom struggle, as well as even really among many U.S. historians, Thurman is not a particularly well-known figure. Why do you think that is? Why has Thurman operated under or been seen so under the radar for so many years?
Yeah, you know, it's always funny when I've spoken to historians about writing a biography of Howard Thurman. I'm waiting for the next question is who, is what you generally get when you're telling people that. I think there are several reasons. Thurman did not seek the limelight. He was retiring. There's a letter to Jesse Jackson in 1971. Jackson wanted him to be a featured speaker. He said, that's not my way of working. He wasn't active participant in the civil rights movement. There's no pictures of him marching with King. And I think, you know, it would be better for biographers if he had done that. It would make our job a little easier. But I think beyond that, I think mainstream opinion did not take Black intellectuals very seriously. That the extent to which Black intellectual life was ignored by the mainstream media is remarkable. It really played very little role. His most important book, Jesus and the Disinherited, which came out in 1949, had no major reviews in mainstream newspapers, white newspapers. And, you know, and I think the fact that he was seen as religious, I think, made him sort of a niche sort of figure. And all of those, I think, contributed to his lack of recognition for the general public.
Yeah, I mean, I've for a long time, I have sort of thought that in sort of mainstream culture, and maybe that just means white culture, but maybe it doesn't, that it's almost throughout the 20th century and into the 21st century, there's sort of room in the culture for, you know, one or two or three Black figures. And then a lot of people just get ignored, right? So, you know, you have Du Bois in back in, you know, 100 plus years ago, you know, you may have a Richard Wright or Baldwin or Ellison, and then later, you know, a Cornel West and now a Ta-Nehisi Coates, but that there's all of these figures who are contributing to this tremendously rich intellectual life of Black America that don't really get the attention that they deserve. And it feels to me like Thurman almost is a stand-in for a Pauli Murray, for instance, or so many amazing, you know, Rustin, so many people that just don't get the attention that they deserve. And I don't know, that's kind of a more of a comment than a question, to use the academic's least favorite term, but do you see it that way? I mean, or do you see Thurman's relative obscurity in a sort of a different light?
As you said, I think there's a strain of American historians that stops at Du Bois and King and see those as the two dominant figures in 20th century Black intellectual history, King has tended to, obscure the wealth of people, and I can give you some names, but, when he was, people like Ralph Bunche, E. Franklin Frazier, Benjamin Mays, all these people who were sort of like a generation older than King and set the stage, I think, intellectually for like the re, both in terms of Black radical nonviolence as a theory, and in terms of like, I think, redefining the meaning of American democracy, which I think is what Thurman and a number of these other people did. And I think, my hope of the book is I'd like people to read it, but I'd like people to rediscover Thurman and read some of his works. And it's even better if you're interested to listen to Thurman. Boston University has a virtual listening room, which has hundreds of his sermons available. And you get more from listening to him speak than just seeing his words on the page.
So maybe it's time to sort of get into the nitty gritty a little bit, and to talk about Thurman's thought and how it becomes influential on King and others. And so, I guess, how does Thurman start developing, this really kind of pioneering mysticism, which is not something that, Americans, I think about a whole lot generally. But he becomes this deeply invested in mysticism, ends up being a proponent of nonviolence, meeting Gandhi. Can you lead us on that journey a little bit?
He writes about being a very lonely person growing up in Daytona. One thing he never wrote about in his life is he was born out of wedlock. And I think he always felt embarrassed by this. And he had a lonely childhood. He was a nature mystic. He found God in nature. His mother and grandmother were pious. He was a Black Baptist and went through that. But his vision of Christianity was always unconventional. He did not see Jesus as the Son of God. And he developed, I think, his own theology. And his theology is it was not Jesus-centered as opposed to a lot of the Black church. It was connected to God. He had some training in mysticism. And one thing about Thurman is, to the extent that he's acknowledged, it is as a forerunner of King. And everybody who writes 20th century Black history, King is like the big cheese. If you connect what you're doing to King, that's fine. And he certainly was an influence on King. But his influence goes beyond the Black church or African Americans. He was one of the major shapers of, what people call spirituality, that you can find God outside of church, that for his mysticism was you find the part of within you that can impel you to do great, great deeds, to risk your life. And he reshaped and reoriented, I think, a lot of progressive American religion. And, I think the question for progressive religion generally is, can progressive religion have the social glue that religion has? Religion remains a very important force in our life. Can religion be something that's inclusive rather than exclusive? And all of these questions, I think, were key for Thurman. He was a pacifist from the early 20s. He was a membership of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. And he always wrote he was opposed to militarism and overseas wars, like so many people were in the aftermath of World War I. But for him, pacifism and nonviolence always was a way to deal with the explicit and implicit violence of being Black. in the South and being Black in America. And it was this, the personal strength he got from that was the key to his nonviolence. A lot of this was from Gandhi, who, you know, reinterpreted pacifism. It's very much a personal movement. It's a matter of how you, you know, pacifism changed from well-to-do white people trying to end war to a personal commitment to a whole range of different, sectarianism, pacifism. So he went to India in 1935 and 36 on behest of, the American Student Christian Federation, sort of like the YMCA, YWCA. And he got to Gandhi, and they had a long discussion about nonviolence. And Gandhi told him, make your life a sermon. He talked about nonviolence as a force in nature. I always see it sort of like it's like Star Wars. It's like it's the force that controls things. And at the end of the conversation, Gandhi said to him, I'm not quoting exactly, well, it may be through the Negro that the unadulterated message of nonviolence reaches the world. And that became sort of a catchphrase during the civil rights movement.
I mean, if I recall from your book correctly, you know, Gandhi himself had a kind of not fully enlightened position on the Black races of the world, and that, you know, am I correct that he sort of had some difficulty sort of seeing that become, you know, that statement, of course, as you point out, becomes pretty central in the 1960s. But at the time, isn't Gandhi kind of ambivalent about the role of Africans and the African diaspora in nonviolence?
Well, you know, because Gandhi lived in South Africa for two decades, from 1893 to 1914, and he did not extend his Satyagraha campaign to Native Africans. He limited to persons of Indian descent. And, you know, he's been, I think, rightly criticized for this. Gandhi, I think some of his view that if Africans were included, it would have been possible for nonviolence to be the method, that it would have become more violent. Gandhi was always a nationalist. I think he liked working with Indians, and he didn't know if it would work more generally with other people. It's hard to say that it was a successful strategy, that by ignoring Africans. And Sermon's wife, Sue Bailey Sermon, directly questioned him about that, and Gandhi did not give a good answer. But, you know, Sermon was used to taking what he wanted from people, from his white instructors at Rochester Theological Seminary, many of whom were oblivious to the race question, and from Rufus Jones, his main teacher of mysticism. He learned to take what he wanted from people, not expect people to be perfect and to understand the race question was something that he didn't expect white people to do. And it bothered him, but not to the extent that he wouldn't work with people who felt didn't understand it.
A couple of times you've mentioned Thurman's wife. Can you talk a little bit more about her and the way that she helped shape his life? I mean, I think like so many powerful couples, she often gets, pushed into the background a little bit. And that's a reflection, of course, of society at this time. But can you talk a little bit more about her and her influence on him and the larger picture that you're telling?
Sue Bailey Sermon was a few years younger than Sermon, as opposed to Sermon, who came from a poor, really poor background. She was from the Black middle class. Her grandfather had been in the Arkansas legislature during Reconstruction. And they met first originally at Spelman and Morehouse. She became a national secretary for the YWCA. She was Thurman's second wife. His first wife, Katie Kelly, died of tuberculosis in 1930. They married in 1932. She put her career on hold for a few years when they were raising two children. She was very close to Mary McLeod Bethune, who Thurman had known from the time he was six. Mary McLeod Bethune was in Daytona, her school was in Daytona, so they knew each other very well. And in 1955, Thurman gave the main eulogy at Mary McLeod Bethune's funeral. That she was more extroverted than he was. And I think he tended to be, more reserved. And she wrote a number of books. She was very interested in Black history. She published a book on Black pioneers in California with Nathan Huggins, who was a prominent Black historian. They did work on Black history in Massachusetts. One frustration, though, I must say, is that when the Thurman papers were given to Boston, they did not include very many personal papers from the couple. And husbands and wives tend not to write to each other as much as you do other people because you're living together. But I think this was both Howard's decision and Sue's decision, that they didn't want their personal life being pried and poked at by biographers. And as a result, it's a little difficult to say how the marriage worked, how they influenced each other. But it clearly was important in all sorts of ways. I should say that Thurman was quite a feminist before he met, that he wrote, he was very influenced by this white South African feminist, Olive Schreiner. And his BA thesis, 1926, at Rochester Theological Seminary, The Basis of Sex Morality, was a blazingly feminist statement of inequalities and the need, how women are being treated in society. So, she's quite a remarkable person, and more work needs to be done on her.
Yeah, very, very interesting. So we don't have too much time left, and I think that there's so much, Thurman's life is so complex, and there's so much to talk about that, everyone's going to have to read the book. But to focus on a couple things I think that we need to make sure we get to. Let me ask you a couple questions about his influence on the civil rights movement. I mean, you pointed out earlier that, everybody becomes an influence on King in the world of 20th century Black history, because, that's kind of a selling point in a sense. But Thurman is hugely important on King. How does this happen, right? I mean, how does somebody who is not explicitly an activist become such a central influence, not only on King, but on Farmer, on the larger nonviolent movement, on this entire generation of Black activists that really, change America in such a profound way?
Well, Farmer, I should say, was Thurman's student at Howard University. So that can, and Pauline Murray was also a student at Howard, so that connection was really very close. And when Farmer started the Congress of Racial Equality, which started as part of Fellowship of Reconciliation, Thurman got Farmer his job, and Thurman clearly was the inspiration and the first organized interracial nonviolence efforts took place under Farmer in like 1942. Thurman's most important book is Jesus and Disinherited, which was certainly his most influential book, published in 1949. The main argument of the book is that there were three hounds of hell, as he describes it, fear, deception, and hatred that shape the lives of the disinherited, the oppressed. And his goal in the book was how to overcome these hounds of hell. Let me just say briefly that Thurman's original, he gave a series of lectures in 48, and he'd been working on this for many years in 48, and he called the lectures The Religion of Jesus and the Disinherited. For Thurman, the religion of Jesus was different than Christianity. It was Jesus' closeness to God. And it was not limited to Christianity. The publishers didn't like the title and suggested Jesus and the Disinherited, which to some extent distorts the message of the book. Thurman suggested calling the book The Hounds of Hell. And his editor wrote back, this sounds like a Sherlock Holmes novel mystery, and I don't, you know, we're not going to publish it under that title. But I think in some ways it's a better title than the one that they chose. So the title of my book, Against the Hounds of Hell, comes from Thurman's suggestion for the title. The book, I think, the reinterpretation of American democracy, putting the emphasis that fear and deception, you know, are so important. And democracy is more about voting. It's about overcoming fear. It's about living lives with dignity. All of these things, which I think have become a key part of democratic thinking in recent decades, I think Thurman and a few other people were pioneering. Thurman had known King. Thurman knew King, you know, Daddy King, Martin Luther King Sr., from the late 20s on. Jesus and Disinherited was published in April 1949. We know that Martin Luther King Jr. read it because he, as was his unfortunate habit, he plagiarized it in a student paper several months later. And there are reports that it was one of his favorite books, and he often kept it with him. So he it was a key influence, I think, in shaping. And my opinion is, it's his first real influence to radical nonviolence. And just one quick, I think, funny story that in 1954. The president of Dillard University in New Orleans wrote to Thurman wanting a new dean of chapel. And said, I've heard good things about this Martin Luther King Jr. What do you think about him? And Thurman wrote back, well, he's okay. He's a little young. And he recommended somebody else for the position. So when I read that, I said, did this change history? Would he have been in New Orleans, you know, in just 1 year later when Rosa Parks, all that sort of stuff happened, and it didn't. And I think I think what's interesting about it is like both that King, when Thurman knew him at Boston, maybe he was a little callow, he hadn't grown, and he had not yet become the figure he would be. But I think Thurman's vision of nonviolence as basically having to give people strength to deal with oppressions and deal with it, to overcome fear, to say what you want, and to overcome hatred, which I think is the most important part, I think was a key influence on John Lewis, on Thurman, on Farmer Pauli Murray, on many of the major figures of the civil rights movement.
Well, let me close by just asking you then one last question to build on that, which is what is, you know, we live in an era of hate and fear today to no small extent, unfortunately. And what is the message that we as Americans or citizens of the world today can take from Howard Thurman?
It's not that Thurman had any better answer to these questions than we do, right? I mean, I think we're all searching for you know, it's he believed, you know, and that blacks and whites in America, people around the world have to work together because they have no alternative, because this is the country that he would, you know, he was proud of being an American. He would not be separated from it. He searched for a common ground and emphasizing what people have in common rather than what people were different. He insisted that black history and blacks were as universal as white history. And this was, I think, one of his major insights. You know, the thing about radical nonviolence ultimately is you try to convince people that they're wrong. And the problem with coercion, Thurman often said, is you never convince anybody by trying to force them to do things. And I think the question we face is, the civil rights movement did what it did. There is a ferocious backlash. And if it ended, legal segregation, it didn't convince people that this had been right. And, obviously we see it in, the former president and the Republican Party today. I'm not sure what the answer is. Thurman, could be mistaken. He didn't have all of the answers, but I think looking for what he called the common ground, and he did not see the common ground as a place where it was a matter of dull compromises and everybody settles for half a loaf, where people can realize their potential is what he was looking for. If it sounds a little abstract and unreal, I think it's still something to strive for. I don't see how America is going to, get any better if being as bitterly divided as it is. I don't think there's a clear way to overcome it. I mean, I think it's the same problem the civil rights movement faced with nonviolence versus rejecting nonviolence. And I think we're, in a similar position today. I think Thurman was an astute and acute reader of American history, of religious history. I think I said this before, that I think Thurman's question is, can the tremendous social force of religion be harnessed for good? That religion is too important to ignore, is too important to say, try to stamp it out. And Thurman's, whole life was, can religion become a positive force for bringing people together? I think the record on that is very much open, but I think it's, it's hard not to look at America today and see religion is one of the main reasons we've got into the mess we're in. And I think, progressive thinkers like Thurman offer one way out.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky questions. And I think that somebody like Thurman is one of many sort of people from the past that can help us try to find a way out of all of this. That's great.
Yeah. I mean, just to say it again, I think his questions as much of his answers is why I think we need to read someone like Thurman.
No, that's a great way to actually to end the conversation. And Peter, I thank you again. We've been talking today with Peter Eisenstadt about his brand new book, Against the Hounds of Hell, A Life of Howard Thurman, published by the University of Virginia Press. Peter, thanks again for spending some time with us.
Thanks so much.
And we'll be back soon with another edition of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.